Chapter 14. Miller had only a moment to brace himself, and then Pirate was on him, charging maniacally forward with the spear leveled. Miller just managed to push the spear aside before it would have impaled him through the chest, and then he took the full force of Pirate's body. His wounded leg crumpled under the other's furious charge, and he was down, on his back, struggling to keep Pirate off him. Pirate lunged again with the spear, and Miller barely managed to roll away. With all his strength, he brought his good leg around and swept Pirate's legs out from under him. Pirate fell. The spear clattered away to the side. Miller struggled to stand and take advantage, but he was too slow. Pirate was up again, on the balls of his feet, ready. Miller backed off a step. Pirate jumped at him, and Miller launched a kick at his stomach. Pirate pushed it aside and threw a fist at Miller's head. If Miller had not rolled the other way, the fist would have landed hard. It still grazed him and made his ears ring. The pirate was directly in front of him, launching a salvo of punches. Miller blocked and ducked, landed one of his own to the center of his opponent's stomach, and took one on the arm that numbed his elbow. For a moment, it was a fairly even contest, but Pirate was fresh, and Miller had just been through a hellish ordeal and had no reserves of energy. He could feel his strength melting away. He was barely able to lift his arms to defend himself. Pirate recognized Miller's condition and backed him up, step by step, until Miller came up against the case shielding the artifact. Exhausted and blocked, Miller was trapped, and they both knew it. All Pirate had to do was step in and finish it. Instead, he paused a moment to gloat, regarding Miller with a wolfish smile of victory. And in that moment, Miller stepped to one side and lifted the panel of the artifact's packing case. Pirate was hurled to the floor. He looked like he'd been hit by an invisible piano, dropped from 50 stories up. Crouched behind the other protective panels, Miller watched as Pirate's body slowly spread out across the floor under the increased weight. No one had ever been this close, only one step away from the artifact, and as its full power was unleashed on Pirate, he had no more chance than a snowflake in a blast furnace. Miller watched with growing horror as Pirate's body puddled outward, taking up twice its normal space as it flattened, spread, and turned into a red paste. Pirate could only gasp once, gurgle, and die as his face was sucked into the spreading red pool along with the rest of his body. His bones collapsed, and the remains were no more than a quarter of an inch thick. Miller slid the panel back into place. He was still horrified at the gelatinous mess before him that had been a man a minute ago. True, the man had repeatedly tried to kill him, but he'd been a man nonetheless. And Miller was no murderer. He looked away. Above him on the ledge, the conch trumpet sounded for, what, the 50th time? Miller looked up to the chief. She raised her arms, the right one holding the red-feathered spear, if you forgot, and waved the spear three times across the silent crowd. Then she very carefully broke it over her knee and began scattering handfuls of the red feathers as she ripped them off the broken shaft. Miller limped slowly over to Cook's body. It was not liquefied as Pirate's was, since it was much farther back from the artifact, but it was flattened and badly beat up. Between the pounding Cook had taken from increased gravity and from the rocks, and from being taken over by whatever the strange being from the future had been, his remains would have called for a closed casket service. But there was no casket, and in any case, Miller needed to look at his friend's face to accept what had happened, so he stood and looked down at what was left of Dr. J. Cook. Oddly, the face now looked more like his friend than it had since they left Ruunapouaque Island. There was some peace showing on Cook's face now, some sense of quiet. Maybe not much, but more than Cook had had when they arrived here. Miller buried Cook on the beach, facing northwest, back toward Berkeley. It was a silly, sentimental gesture, one that would probably have embarrassed his friend. Cook had had no particular attachment to Berkeley. To him, it was just the first place to have the good sense to offer him tenure. So bury him like it's frickin' Jerusalem or whatever. Miller was just as surprised by his action. When he was done pushing the dirt over Cook's body, he stood for a moment, just looking down. He didn't pray, although he felt an odd urge to say something. He just stood for a moment, feeling foolish, then turned away and walked back to the village. The chief and her elders were sitting in a circle in the center of the village. They were not talking, and they didn't seem to be doing anything beyond simply sitting. Around them, throughout the village, the rest of the people were just sitting, too, or lying down with their faces covered, or leaning against the doorways to their huts. The whole village seemed to be in a state of profound shock. It occurred to Miller that they probably were. He had killed their god, and they knew of no other. The artifact had been the anchor of their existence, the central, provable fact in their system of belief, and he'd taken away its power. What would they believe in now? Miller walked slowly to the center of the village. All eyes followed him, not with hostility or anger, but not with joy, either. No one could say how he should be treated. There had never been anyone like him before. He was the God Slayer, and no one knew whether he was just a lucky man or if he might be a god himself. Miller stood next to the chief. She looked up, then away. He sat down next to her. She still said nothing, and between his exhaustion and the fact that he was still struggling with the dialect, Miller had nothing to say, either. The chief pulled a twig from a mound of dirt and began to scratch at the ground, idly.
Amotaku,
she said. Goodbye, Ku. It was true, then. They didn't know what to do about their dead god. Of course, he was not sorry that he'd killed Ku. It had been Ku or him. But Miller did feel some responsibility for the people. It could not leave them in this state. Other cultures had sickened and died out completely under less strain, and this particular culture had already strayed so far from the Polynesian norm that it would be impossible to nudge it back again. But what to do? The logical course was to replace the fallen god with whatever had vanished it. In this case, that meant the great god Miller. Stone statues in his image, blushing virgins dragged naked before him, offerings of fruit, fish, shells piled high in front of him, universal adoration and reverence. The thought made him want to puke. Besides, he couldn't hang out and play God the rest of his life. He had to get off this island, get back to Berkeley, and publish! My God, the things he'd discovered! On Runapoake, as well as on this island! His career was absolutely made when he published all this. Not just the sociological stuff, but the artifact. What was it? How did it work? All he knew was that it was incredibly powerful, and it stood the laws of physics on their ears. If you could get it studied properly, in a lab, what might they learn? What incredible benefits for mankind might be locked up in the thing? It would not just make his reputation, it would give some meaning to Cook's horrible death, make his name last as co-discoverer. And anyway, he'd promised Cook, or whoever Cook had been, that he'd see the artifact to safety. Whether to the safety of an agent from the future at the airport in Tahiti, or the physics lab at Berkeley, remained to be seen. He had to leave, as soon as possible, and get back to civilization. But he could not leave the island to rot away in despair. What if they had followed the path of Easter Island and Runapoake and literally ate themselves out of existence? If he could stop it, he must. So, how did he give these people something to replace what he'd taken? Miller got up and walked along the beach, still limping on his injured leg. He waded out waist deep, letting the salt water soak through his wounds. It stung at first, but it cleaned them, and soon began to soothe the pain. He waded back to shore, still turning over the problem. His plane was pulled safely up where he left it, and he sat in the shade of the wing.
All right, Miller,
he said to himself.
This is a perfect final exam question. Given the previous culture and how it died, what can replace it without killing this micro-society?
An hour later, night was falling, and he had his answer. The details had to be worked out, but the rough outline would work. Miller searched the nearby forest and found wood. He dragged it down to the beach, his wounds throbbing. He was exhausted, and he hurt like hell all over, but this had to be done, and done tonight. Using a cup full of gasoline to start the blaze, he soon got a roaring bonfire going on the beach. He took an empty 5-gallon gas can from the storage area of the plane and, sitting cross-legged beside the fire, began to drum on it. He chanted all the snatches of Shakespeare he could remember, all the old poems.
Oh, once there was an elefunk who tried to use the telefunk.
It sounded surprisingly impressive. And then songs, nursery rhymes, pages from his doctoral dissertation, anything at all he could think of to keep an imposing rhythm going. After a while, he heard footsteps and glanced up at the path. A young boy stood there, watching him curiously. Miller thumped extra hard, told the boy,
tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools along to dusty death.
It sounded solemn, even scary, even to Miller. The boy took off, running as fast as he could back to the village. The chief came back first, then the elders. Within half an hour, they were all there, watching him, none daring to approach him, but none wanting to miss anything either. Miller poured it on. He let the words burble out of him in great streams of consciousness, building them to a fever pitch just as the fire began to die down to the coals. And when he judged the time was right, partly because he couldn't think of anything else to say, he stood slowly and carefully, raising his arms to the heavens, his back to the people from the village, reaching carefully to the waistband of his shorts, concealing his movements from the villagers. He pulled his flare gun, taken from the plain stores, and fired it into the air. He had meant the flare gun to be a dramatic touch, something to make it look like he was communicating with the gods. Just a little parlor trick to impress people who had never seen anything like it before. The response was all he could have wished for. As the flare arced over the water and up into the sky in a beautiful red streak, the people murmured and stepped nervously away from him. A few fell to their knees, as if to worship him. Miller tucked the pistol back into his shorts and quickly changed his mind. It was hot enough to raise blisters. Instead, he dropped it by his feet and kicked sand over it. Then he turned to face the chief. In a few hours, using his sparse knowledge of their dialect and a stick to trace ideas in the sand, Miller outlined the new religion. It was simple, and as similar to the old one as he could make it. The basic idea was that he, as a representative of the gods, promised that one day Ku would return. Until then, the people must show that they were worthy by keeping to his ways, and they must, in addition, welcome all strangers with hospitality, because one day one of the new arrivals would be Ku, coming back in disguise to test them. In the meantime, he told the chief, he had to take the old Ku back to the land of the gods, so all his brothers and sisters could make him well again. The chief was impressed. Miller could not be sure whether she believed him or not, but the old girl was politician enough to recognize a way out of a major crisis when she saw one, and she quickly agreed to all that Miller said and then announced it to the people. Their culture had changed, but the people were still Polynesian. What else would they be? They adapted to change quickly, and they marked all events of major importance the same way. Within a half hour of the chief's announcement, a major party was underway around the bonfire on the beach. Miller knew he had to stay for a while, just to pee politique. And out of common politeness, he had to drink a certain amount of the native beer, too. It was stronger than he had assumed it would be. A lot stronger. And they kept passing him big bowls of the stuff, and he had to take a sip each time. It would have been rude not to. When the time came that he knew he had to lie down or pass out on the beach, he found that his legs were no longer working properly. Probably from the strain, the injuries. He really hadn't had that much beer. Not much at all. And because the natives were such a polite bunch, really, underneath all that sacrificing stuff, they cheerfully helped him up the path to the village. Very nice of them, really. And they seemed to be having so much fun helping, he let them think he really needed their help. It was really just the leg wound, of course. He could walk if he wanted to. He was fine. Never felt better. But he hated to disappoint them by being able to walk. Let them help. God bless them all. That was actual words from this book. All of that was... They took him to a hut he thought he recognized. He did recognize it. It was Pirate's Hut. Sure, the old thing about when you kill somebody, you get all their stuff. He could use it to sleep in. Very nice place, really. Damned nice of them. His eyes felt a little dry and sticky, probably from the heat of the bonfire. He closed them for just a second to get them wet again. It felt good. Very good. Cool. Peaceful. Pleasant. And it stopped the awful spinning Pirate's Hut was doing. When he opened his eyes again, the villagers were gone. There was no sound in the hut, and Miller assumed he was alone. Far away, he could hear the noises of the dying party down on the beach. The cool night breeze was blowing across him. It felt wonderful, riffling across his bare skin. Bare skin? But he had been dressed when he flopped down here just a minute ago. What happened to his pants? His shirt! Miller sat up and looked around the room. It wasn't the best idea he'd ever had, since the room began to spin again. He closed his eyes, and a cool hand pressed against his forehead.
Para acabato.
The soft and musical voice said.
Lie down.
Miller blasted his eyes open. It hurt. He was looking into the gently amused eyes of Yuki, who was trying to push him softly back down onto the sleeping mat. Miller's first thought when he saw her was,
My God, but I'm naked.
His second thought was,
My God, so is she.
He let Yuki push him back down. End of chapter.